KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business. Top Gun Maverick's big box office provided proof that for the right film, people would go to the movies. James Cameron acknowledges that success, but he also offers some context.
Top Gun was such a triumph. Nobody had made that kind of money in 3 years. But we got to put it in perspective. Top Gun was a hit in America, and it did okay overseas by Avatar standards. We made 3/4 of our money globally and 1/4 of it in the U.S. on the first film.
History has repeated itself with Avatar: The Way of Water, which has shot past Top Gun Maverick in overall box office and crushed it overseas. In part two of our conversation with Cameron, he talks about getting the Avatar sequel a release in China, how he spent millions developing photoreal CG water that he doesn't even really want you to notice, and why he chose to make a bunch of Avatar sequels despite being tempted to walk away from filmmaking. But first we banter. Stick around. It's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my colleague in banter, Matt Bellany. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So, the Golden Globes. You have written much more about the Golden Globes than I have, but they went ahead and did it on Tuesday night. This was after they were not broadcast last year. They had a very small, non-noticeable ceremony after the LA Times had written about the lack of diversity in the membership ranks, as well as some of the corruption, you know, that some of these members of the Hollywood Foreign Press were not exactly press, and they took all kinds of goodies, and the voting did not seem on the up and up necessarily, and the publicist didn't like it because some of these members would annoy talent and sort of demanding to have events with them and then asking these ridiculous questions. So the Globes was in eclipse, and the big question was, could it come back? Now NBC, they sort of renegotiated. They aired it on a Tuesday night as opposed to a Sunday, which is how it used to be, with lots of splashy parties right afterward. Everybody has backed away from that this year. Netflix did a party the Sunday before, and Universal's doing a party the Friday after, and they're not calling them Globes parties. So they're celebrations instead. But they did manage to put on the show, and they did manage to get major talent. They got Gerard Carmichael, I will note, to take the gig. He went right out of the gig and addressed that, and addressed at least one of the elephants in the room.
And I'll tell you why I'm here. I'm here because I'm black.
So that happened, and then people like Steven Spielberg were there. People, important talent, was there. We know that the Globes, while it hasn't been taken all that seriously as the Guild nominations as a bellwether for Oscars, it's a chance to audition and to show your gratitude. And there was a lot of gratitude expressed on Tuesday night.
Absolutely. And I think that the win for the Globes, first of all, was getting back on the air. The fact that they had a show on NBC, even if it was a Tuesday night, that's a win for them. And the show was not a disaster. I mean, I know that's a very low bar for success here, but that's what we're talking about. I mean, there was no big blow up controversy. You know, Gerard Carmichael took some swings at them and others did too. But it was generally a normal award show. There were nice moments. There were some big stars. Brad Pitt, Rihanna were there. And they came out of it, did the show, and someone now has to decide whether this show is worth picking up, because I don't believe that NBC will be going for it. It's not just the controversies for NBC. They don't have a spot on Sunday nights. Since the NFL added an extra week, that first Sunday in January is now Sunday Night Football. So if NBC were to pick it up, they'd have to relegate it to a midweek slot or go later in January, which the Globes doesn't want because they lose all the leverage of being before the Oscar nominations. So I think someone else will likely come in and pick this up. And the question is who? You know, ABC has the Oscar relationship, so probably not there. Maybe CBS, maybe a cable network, or most likely will be a streaming service because they all now have their advertising tiers. So they're looking for live events that they can plug in and sell ads against. Netflix just picked up the SAG Awards starting in 2024. And I have a feeling that a streamer will come in and take the Globes.
I mean, I think it's a bit tricky. I have no idea what Netflix is paying for the SAG Awards. And I should mention that many of us, including me at KCRW, are members of SAG-AFTRA. We don't know what they're paying for it. I mean, NBC negotiated a lower price for the Globes this year, from $60 million to about $40 million. That's still a lot of money. And there's a lot of pressure on all of the streamers, especially at the legacy companies. So making it a cost-effective presentation is a question. And, you know, we at this time haven't seen the ratings for the Globes on a Tuesday night on a broadcast network, but we're not necessarily expecting them to be fabulous.
No, it'll probably be down, especially from the high of 2020, where, well, it wasn't an all-time high, but in 2020, this show got 18 million viewers and change. It had a football lead-in on NBC, and the ratings are not going to be anywhere near that. I mean, they'd be lucky if they got a third or close to a half of those numbers. But if you're talking about the streaming universe, they may not necessarily care if the audience declines there. These streamers are looking to establish themselves, and they do have pretty big audiences on places like Netflix, Amazon, and even Apple. These are global audiences. They could do a lot of promotion and maybe get some people to sign up just for it. So there's a lot of other incentives that may go into a streamer bidding on this. And clearly, Netflix sees value in the SAG Awards, which was on the Turner Networks and was dropped as part of the cost cutting going on at Warner Brothers Discovery. So that'll be an interesting wrinkle.
Yeah, I'm trying to imagine who signs up for a streamer to show the Globes.
Well, Amazon has already put its toe in the water on award shows. They're doing a country music award show. They aired the first one last year. They're doing it again. So, you know, there are shows that have made that trek. And eventually, all of these shows have to figure out what their future is going to be in streaming, because as we know, the audience on linear television will eventually go down to zero. So the Oscars, the Grammys, all of these other shows have to figure out whether they have a future even in a streaming on-demand environment. And, you know, at least for right now, it would make sense for the Globes to bet on that if they have a buyer.
Yes. So meanwhile, we are seeing the awards season shape up. We have the Directors Guild nominations, the very influential SAG nominations, the Golden Globe nominations, I would say less influential, but can cast a spotlight on something and can also give, again, somebody a chance to show that they will not be snotty and will act nice if they get an Oscar nomination. Let me start with the SAG Awards. SAG Awards for the cast. This is an award from a big group, you know, a big block within the Academy, but it doesn't reward shows that are like tiny, small casts necessarily.
Well, but, except the Banshees movie has four people in it and they got nominated.
Okay, an exception, we can say. But they have nominated Babylon, which is a bit of an outlier because I don't think the others have given it similar consideration. As you say, the Banshees of Inisherin. Women Talking got a nomination for Ensemble in the SAG Awards, but the Directors Guild overlooked it. Everything Everywhere All at Once, I think, is across the board. It's a little confusing. And I think Steven Spielberg's across the board with the Fablemans.
Yeah, the only real surprise on SAG to me was that Michelle Williams did not get nominated for lead actress for The Fablemans. I thought that was a surprise. And I would have thought that the DGA would have given a nod to Sarah Polley for Women Talking. It's an all-male DGA nominee list, and that is not a great look.
The Directors Guild, which is also very influential, they did nominate Top Gun Maverick, which a lot of people are seeing as a front runner, sort of this hugely popular movie and kind of the feel-good right movie at the right time, and almost in a way that a very different movie Coda was last year when they had to win. So Top Gun did not get recognized by the Screen Actors Guild, which there were multiple actors, but I don't know if what you would call an ensemble exactly. And I don't know if it means anything, but I suspect that, you know, for sure we will see it nominated. It's kind of funny at the Globes, of course, Tom Cruise is the one who had sent back three awards and said he wouldn't attend. And Gerard Carmichael did have some humor at his expense with that joke about Scientology that seemed to make certain people in the room a little uneasy.
Look, I'm just the host briefly or whatever, but I have a pitch. I think maybe we take these three things and exchange them for the safe return of Shelley Miscavige.
Shelley Miskovich joke. Did not see that one coming. And no, obviously, the Globes were not going to give any awards to Top Gun Maverick. But it is a bit surprising that SAG ignored it because, you know, you say it's a one-man show, but that's a pretty big one man.
And, I mean, Kilmer is in it, and there is more than one person in it.
All the young guys were in it. Yeah. So, yeah, that's a bit surprising. And then you see someone like Joe Kaczynski get a DGA nomination over, I might add, Jim Cameron. And that, to me, is a pretty major snub. If Avatar Way of Water is anything, it is a directing vehicle for Jim Cameron. And obviously, he got a DGA nom for the first one, so this is a bit surprising.
Yeah, Joe Kaczynski, of course, the director of Top Gun Maverick, and getting that nomination, and Jim Cameron not getting it is kind of surprising. I want to be clear, I'm not disparaging the Top Gun actors, per se. It just very much feels like the Tom Cruise show.
Yeah, of course, but that's something that you thought maybe the SAG Awards would honor. He didn't get an individual nod either, and they had an opportunity to do that.
Yeah, well, as I said, I think we can be confident that Top Gun will be very much in the mix, and a few others, you know, I think The Fabelmans, and there are 10 slots.
Yeah, that's the thing, is there are 10 slots for Best Picture this year. So the fact that the DGA only has 5 for their Director of the Year, and SAG only has 5 cast ensemble honors, so all of these movies, I think, are going to get in for Best Picture, including, I would say, Babylon, and I think some of these others like Women Talking that are sort of considered bubble movies.
Yes, and as we've mentioned in previous years, the method of tallying the vote, where you rank your choices, and don't ever expect me to be able to explain or understand this, it can lead to somewhat surprising results, and this could be a year with a lot of splits.
Yeah, that's the thing, is the ranked voting really rewards movies that people feel strongly about in the nominations phase. And then in the winner phase, it is designed to reflect broad support, meaning it's not necessarily about your number one pick, but it's about which movie has the most number twos and number threes. And that's where you're supposed to get a consensus.
Exactly. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, founding partner of Puck News.
Get away from her, you bitch!
I'll be back.
Come with me if you want to live.
Hasta la vista, baby.
Jack, I want you to draw me like one of your French girls. Wearing this.
All right.
Wearing only this.
As you probably know, those are just a few iconic moments from the films of James Cameron. The director has had the all-time top-grossing film twice, first with Titanic in 1997, and again in 2009 with the original Avatar, which still occupies the top spot. More than a decade after the first Avatar hit theaters, the sequel, Avatar: The Way of Water, has already secured a spot on the top 10 list of highest-grossing films. And it has legs, long legs. When we talked in December, Cameron didn't know yet how the movie would perform because it was just about to open. Cameron wound up missing the Los Angeles premiere of his long gestating movie because of COVID, but talked to us over Zoom the next day, and as you'll hear, he was contending with some hoarseness. I think you and Top Gun would be the two movies in recent history that affirm what a movie can do and remind everybody who may have forgotten why we do expensive marketing campaigns in the movie business. Not, I don't. They do.
Yeah. Top Gun was such a triumph. Nobody had made that kind of money in 3 years.
Yeah.
But we got to put it in perspective. Top Gun was a hit in America, and it did okay overseas by Avatar standards. We made 3/4 of our money globally, and 1/4 of it in the U.S. on the first film. If that ratio holds, and I don't see why it wouldn't, then we don't have to do Top Gun business in the U.S.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, you got a China date, and I'm not sure how to interpret it because I can't figure out what's going on in China in terms of, and you know, we all saw that the
demonstrators
were. We're
just going to have to get it out there and see it. We're not as in control in China as we are in other markets.
Right.
They kind of do their own thing. We're supposed to be on 60,000 screens in China. So
what a number, my God.
You know, even if people are hanging back a bit, we were on 2,800 screens in China on our first release.
Wow.
So I'm guessing we can probably do okay.
We can do a little better. We all saw the demonstrators saying we want to see a movie.
Well, look,
here you are.
The thing is that there's a geopoliticalization factor here that I can't predict. I don't know enough about Chinese politics, but I do know that the Chinese audience loves Avatar and they love 3D. It's still a big thing for them. And this film delivers. And, you know, the Chinese audiences that are, you know, they're quite selective, obviously, they've done their internal test screenings over there, really respond to the family motif as well as the fantasy visuals. So, you know, we feel good about it. I mean, the thing is, if people start going to the movies like crazy and then they start getting sick, then the government may step in. They did step in on us the first time. They pulled us from a bunch of our theaters the first time because we were making too much money and to make room for a Chinese film that was releasing.
So yes, they favor the homegrown. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, look, there's a lot of factors there. All I know is that we didn't particularly pander to the Chinese market any more than we pandered to any other cultural market in the world, but they do love Avatar.
Let me just ask a couple of questions about the main logistics before I let you rest your voice. I think listening to some little interviews with cast, this business of acting underwater is something you developed for this motion capture underwater for this film, if I understand it correctly, and there's a pretty good chance I don't, but maybe I do.
Yeah.
And that, I mean, the free dive component of this, where people were learning how to hold their breath. You got Kate Winslet back after putting her on the water 20 years ago. And she apparently held her, I mean, I saw 7 minutes, but it's not completely holding her breath, right? Maybe there was like some oxygen in there somewhere.
No, not at all. It's 7 minutes and 14 seconds of breath hold, face down in the water, not moving. That's called a static apnea test. And Sigourney did the same test and did 6.5 minutes, I think.
Wow.
So this is a tribute to the training that they all received. The young kids were great, too. Britton Dalton was particularly natural in the water. This is not the first time I've taken a full cast into the water. I did it on The Abyss, although that was more about diving helmets and learning to scuba and then do the helmets. This is breath hold. Breath hold is actually much safer than scuba. You can get screwed up on scuba if you don't keep your head straight in it, you know, by holding your breath and surfacing while you've just taken a breath of compressed air. But breath hold diving is quite safe. In my experience, because I've been doing it for 50 years, anybody can do it. Anybody can improve their time. You know, I don't know, you can probably just unbidden, you could probably hold your breath for a minute. Right now, I guarantee you a week with our trainers and you could do 3.
And was it right that doing the motion capture underwater was the new thing that you had to figure out?
That was one of the things. You know, I would say if people ask me about ranking the challenges on this movie, challenge one highest was the empty page, the start of the writing process. Challenge two was now knowing that we're shooting, that we're going to be in water and underwater, developing performance capture technology for underwater. Challenge three, getting the cast happy and confident in that environment. And challenge four was improving our performance capture pipeline so that we literally had no loss or degradation whatsoever of what the actors created. And I'm not talking about underwater. I got to put this whole underwater thing in perspective. There's probably less than 10% of the movie where people are acting underwater. There's the other 90% where people are acting in air, that people that don't exist. I mean, they're ones and zeros on the screen. They're CG. And yet the emotional affect and nuance is 100% the equivalent of photography. That's really the triumph of the film, if there is one. The technical triumph of the film is the actors got to act with utter confidence that what they were creating was going to be in their characters. I might even put that challenge above underwater performance capture. Mm. You know, what's the biggest challenge in the movie when your characters don't physically exist and can't be photographed? The close-up, the dialogue scene. The thing that's the easiest on a photographic film is the hardest on a performance capture film. And the thing that's the hardest in a photographic film is often the easiest in virtual production. You know, if you want to have 500,000 screaming orcs come over the wall, that's actually about as easy as a close-up to get right. We're attuned by a million years of evolution to every minute nuance of facial musculature and how we talk and emote, and we read each other's faces all day long for eye movement and pupil dilation and subtle fleeting moments of expression and tension in the lips and all those things, you know, and it took us literally years to get that dialed in so that we lost nothing.
If I'm remembering right back to the original Avatar, you were frustrated even then that you felt that these performances were not considered awards worthy or, you know, didn't seem to be ranked that way.
No, I wouldn't put it that way. I thought they were awards worthy, but I was pretty confident. I was pretty confident that they wouldn't get considered because too many people still don't understand what it is that we do. But we're kind of over that now. We just kind of shrug and go, okay, people don't understand it. As long as they pay to go see it, I don't care if they understand it.
Coming up after the break, Jim Cameron talks about how he was tempted to make a career switch instead of making a long-term commitment to the Avatar franchise. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes. Join Jacqueline Coley as she hosts a brand new podcast, Scene on Screen. Meet the innovative people at NBC Universal as they share their journeys, inspirations, and the movies that define them. Each episode is an intimate and fun conversation about the impact of film. Scene on Screen is available now, wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. James Cameron's Avatar, The Way of Water, picks up a few years after the first film left off. Sam Worthington's character, Jake Sully, has become the chief of his Na'vi clan, and he started a family with Neytiri, played by Zoe Saldana. Their community is thriving until, once again, Pandora faces dangerous invaders.
The humans are returning.
They're hunting us.
What's our plan?
This is our home. This is our family. This is our fortress. This is where we make our stand.
We must protect the people.
Let's get it done.
I think you could teach a graduate degree in the science of Avatar and motion capture.
But what's the point? You know, I mean, the point is that the audience doesn't care. There's right. so much of the work that we do, it's what I call getting to zero. Right. So we spend tens of millions of dollars and years of effort to get to zero. Right. And by that, I mean, I could go out with my iPhone and photograph my kid's pool party and the water would look just as good as what we spend, you know, umpteen million dollars creating. The right. difference is we're creating the water because we're doing CG characters. And so we have to have CG water. If we had actors in, you know, Spock makeup, we could just push them in the pool.
Right.
You know what I mean?
You want people to not think about it, basically, I think is the real...
Well, the goal is to create an emotional transparency in an alien face, right? If you think about it, how was it done historically? Slap on some latex rubber and prosthetics. And there are prosthetics that are excellent. But the second you're adding layers on top of the actor's face, you're reducing performance.
Right.
And people are having to act through it in an exaggerated way. Or it's muting what they're doing. Whereas we don't have that at all. We're creating alien makeup, essentially, except that it doesn't diminish what the actors do. I would even say that if you add in the expressiveness of the ears and the tails, we're actually going to 120%.
Yes, I did notice when I was, well, I only got up to pee once too, but I had your permission because you told people it's okay. And right. It's a lot of water, Jim, you know, again, there's a lot of water.
Yeah.
So it makes you think sometimes a little bit about that.
Yeah, people get bogged down on the water and the 3D and the frame rate. And it's like, honestly, those things were the easiest part of it.
No, I didn't because I don't understand those things. But you're saying that's the least of it.
From my standpoint as a director, that's the easiest part of it. Getting the script, working with the actors, doing the design, creating the world, creating the creatures, figuring out how you ride creatures that don't exist. Like, how do you ride them? Well, we built them. We built essentially animatronic creatures and zapped them around in the ocean for real. Figured out how to do it with stunt people and then taught the actors how to do it. It's like making a Western where the horse hasn't been invented yet. And there's nobody that knows how to ride a horse, you know?
Yeah.
That's why I keep saying we spend so much time and energy getting to zero. You do a Western, actor walks in, they can either ride or they can't. If they can't, there's going to be a guy that knows everything about horses, that's ridden horses his or her whole life, and there's going to be a horse that's been around for 20 or 30 million years. Right. With us, you know, we spend a lot of energy getting to zero, getting the ELU to the level of what a horse wrangler would be able to teach you.
Yes. Amazing. I saw somewhere, actually, the last thing I'll say, I guess, is, you know, that you at one point thought you had gone down into your to the Mariana Trench with your submarine vehicle that you had helped design.
My little 10-ton sub.
Your little 10-ton sub. And at that moment, I think I read somewhere you said, maybe I'm done with movies and I just like this stuff and I'm going to do stuff like this and other environmental stuff.
I thought about it very seriously. And it wasn't just whether or not to do an Avatar sequel. It was whether or not to do any film. Because there was nothing, you know, I'm looking at all these reviews today, you know, and it's like, you know, we're going to love the movie, but we're not really going to love it. There's always a snarky take back. And it's like, you know, I much prefer engineering and physics because it's not an opinion.
I get that.
You know, we spend years building a machine that goes in the ocean. It's not in somebody's dumbass opinion whether it works or not. It either works or it doesn't. You know, the second law of thermodynamics is not some jackass's opinion. So it's not a joke. I thought seriously
I'm just laughing because it's true.
It doesn't like to live in a world of opinion. But you know, on the other hand, I'm an artist. You know, I'm an artist, and when anything I create, whether it's a drawing, a painting, a movie, a script, whatever. You put it out there and there's going to be people that like it, people that don't like it. It's pretty much that simple. You're always hoping that somebody will see in it what you put in there, but often they see a lot that you didn't put in and often they don't see what you did put in. Mm. And, you know, there's part of my mind that accepts that as an artist. And there's part of my mind that just says, you know what, fuck it. I'd much rather be doing deep ocean exploration with machines that I build that I know are going to work. And it's not an opinion. Yeah. So, yeah, that was a decision. I decided for a number of reasons that we don't really have time to get into, that doing more Avatar films could be beneficial to the conversation, to the zeitgeist, to our perceptions of our role as guardians of nature, to indigenous communities that are struggling to be heard, to be seen, to be respected. If I thought even that I could do a small amount with these movies, and we did have a belief coming out of the first film that we were doing something good simply because of the number of interactions over the subsequent years that were spawned by that film amongst the indigenous community worldwide and the sustainability thought leaders worldwide. Mm. I thought, okay, maybe we can make this more than just a movie. Now, that way, you know, that's a bit hubristic. And maybe that way lies madness and the seeds of failure, but that was the intention.
Well, you're in it now.
I know, exactly. No pulling out now, right?
No, too late. You have quadruplets, actually, I think.
Yeah, it's like having kids, you know. Once you've done that, you're kind of stuck. But, you know, the other thing is that I love the story and I love the characters and I love my cast. So, you know, I do enjoy the work on a day-to-day basis, and I enjoy the challenge of the work. So that ultimately is, you know, the kind of the life-work balance thing sort of implies that you don't like your work and you got to balance it with your life. But mm-hmm. I love my work, so I don't have to worry about it. If you love what you do, you never work a day in your life.
Yeah, I've heard that. I find it
I plan to live by that. I feel like I have for the last 25 years. So
when I have studio executives screaming at me, I don't necessarily love those days, but I'm willing to deal with it.
You don't have to love every minute of it to love it.
Oh, no, not every minute. Well, I really appreciate you doing this, even though you are currently not well. I hope you don't feel awful.
No, I feel good. I'm going to go work out right now, but I
sound
worse.
Oh, God, be careful, please.
Well, you know, just I got to get the blood moving. I can't sit around. I'm not a sitter-arounder kind of person.
No, that's not my impression over the years, no. James Cameron co-wrote, produced, and directed Avatar, The Way of Water. The film is in theaters everywhere now. Thank you so much, Jim.
Hey, well, it was good talking to you again, Kim. And I'm sure we'll talk again.
I certainly am counting on it.
Okay.
And that's the business. Joshua Farnham produced and edited today's program with help this week from Katie Gilchrist and Matt Schwartz, who mixed the show. You can stream The Business as well as other great KCRW podcasts on the KCRW app. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.